Investigations are continuing into the Pacific Highway incident, but the question remains, what on earth was a truck doing back in 1980 with radioactive isotopes DDT and lychees?
Well, that is a very good question. And I suppose the question is, has much changed in the last 30 years? And I would probably say not a lot, no.
Well, that surprises me. Why hasn't there been some kind of major overhaul of that stuff?
Well, over the last 30 years, there has been major overhauls of the Australian Dangerous Goods Code, which is the code that basically sets out how we transport dangerous goods. But, for example, this code does not take in chemicals that are carcinogenic or mutagenic, or, you know, they cause cancer or mutations or birth defects. It really only deals with chemicals that cause fires or maybe corrosive or oxidizing sort of chemicals. So there's a big hole in our dangerous good code that really does need to be resolved.
What would you define as a toxic or a dangerous substance?
Well, I would define a chemical that is dangerous as a chemical that is dangerous both in the short term, which is what the code deals with, but also in the long term. Because when a fireman or an emergency worker turns up to an accident, they want to know what they're dealing with. And they want to know whether that chemical could cause cancer if it gets onto their skin, or if they're exposed to it, whether it's going to affect their reproductive ability. They want that information. And certainly I know a lot of the emergency services are saying it is time to change our dangerous goods code.
Do we know how many dangerous goods or toxic substances are being moved around the country?
Unfortunately not, no. We've got a good idea what the main areas are, and I would suggest the three main ones that come to mind are the transport of fuel, of course, and we know the number of accidents that have occurred with fuel tankers. Mining chemicals and mining products and waste is probably the next big volume of chemicals. And pool chemicals are something that, you know, there is a huge amount of transport of pool chemicals to and from, you know, production to the shop and of course, home to our private residences.
Well, what can go wrong if, say, a semi-trailer loaded with pool chemicals runs off the road?
Yeah, well, pool chemicals are ones that are very... they're not compatible with each other, so you have to be really careful about which of the pool chemicals that you would carry. If they get wet, they can start a reaction. If they get hot, they can become very flammable. These are really dangerous chemicals which can result in things like chlorine gas being released, and chlorine gas is deadly. So although I think because we handle pool chemicals a lot, we don't think of their dangers, they are very, very serious toxic and hazardous chemicals. But other ones that are of a major worry are the mining chemicals, and because we have such a big mining boom now, we've seen so many times where, you know, for example, in 2010, the Kakadu Highway was closed for a week because a very corrosive mining chemical was spilt, and, you know, the emergency services had to go in and clean it up. And then back in, I think, you know, most of your listeners would remember back in 2006 and 7, the terrible incidents with lead carbonate from the Magellan mines, which basically contaminated the 900-kilometre route down to Esperance, where it was being exported, and resulted in the deaths of, I think, 50,000 birds, contamination of water tanks right along that route, and elevated blood levels in the children of Esperance. So we have many situations where mining chemicals are contaminating the environment. And, of course, then there are many that don't even come under the dangerous goods because they are cancer-causing or reproductive toxins.
And we're talking a lot about the expansion of coal seam gas exploration and mining in this state, and the mid-north coast is one of the areas that's being targeted at the moment. What are some of the chemicals that might be produced as a result of that?
Well, they are, that expansion is very worrying because we're already, we have communities in Queensland who are checking the trucks going in and out of the facilities, taking down the names of chemicals, and they've been supplying some just recently, things like crystalline silica, which is a known lung cancer causer. But it does not need to be classified as a dangerous goods. Other polymers with a carcinogen called acrylamide, again, not a dangerous good, but many of these are being transported because they are used in very, very large amounts in the coal seam gas industry. And I don't think that has received any real attention. But it is about time that we get these chemicals off our roads and onto more safer forms of transport, rail.
In terms of training for those who might be responsible for the transportation of dangerous goods or toxic substances, what sorts of requirements are there?
Well, under the code, which is then enforced by a number of state legislations, in New South Wales it's the Dangerous Goods Road and Rail Transport Act, there are requirements for the drivers to be licensed, for the trucks to be licensed, for the actual drivers to be trained in how to manage and handle this. But the problem is, yes, we have all of these wonderful things, but we do not have the dangerous good inspectors to ensure that this is happening. And this was a recommendation that came out of the lead carbonate fiasco, that yes, it's great to have good legislation, it's great to have good codes, but unless you have inspectors there to ensure compliance, well, then really you're relying on industry self-regulation again. And if you look at the number of accidents we have, I think you would have to suggest that perhaps that self-regulation is not working.
Now, I know the transportation of nuclear waste is highly regulated, but there are so many chemicals that we use in our everyday life that we've almost become complacent about. How has our reliance on convenience contributed to this problem?
Oh, I think it's contributed greatly, and I think you're absolutely right. The sort of chemicals that people rely on, garden pesticides, the surfactants used in their heavy-duty cleaners, heavy metals and various persistent chemicals that are used in chrome products or wood treatment products or even carpet and upholstery cleaning products. Some of these are incredibly toxic and very, very serious. And if you're transporting them in their pure form, which, you know, you often are to companies where they are formulated into the products we buy off the shelf, they are incredibly dangerous. And I think that really is a message for every consumer, every, you know, householder, is we have to look at our consumption of chemicals, and I think, you know, we have to reduce what we would accept is an unsustainable consumption of these chemicals. And this is an issue that's going to be addressed at the Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit, which happens in June this year. There is already the whole issue of unsustainable consumption down on the agenda. It'll be the biggest UN meeting ever. Governments will be coming together to try to work out how we can balance the convenience of our modern lifestyle with the real environmental harms that our unsustainable consumption is doing.
Marion Lloyd-Smith is with us from the National Toxics Network. It's not just what's on our roads, but also what's in our backyards. So many things get dumped illegally. How can we be sure that our backyards and our playgrounds that might be old landfill sites are safe?
Yes, that's a very serious one, particularly for anyone buying a house or even, you know, renting a house. Most of the contaminated sites that we know about are listed on your deed. So there's a section that's required to list if it has ever been a known hazardous waste or rubbish dump or dumping site. But the problem is, as we discovered with the highway incident a couple of weeks ago, there are so many occurrences of dumping that we're just not, you know, we don't know about. How do you know when you buy a house that the owner before didn't have a bit of old pesticide in the shed and thought, oh, well, rather than hand it in, I'll just bury it in the backyard? Unfortunately, this is a situation that happens all the time. In the rural areas, for example, the old cattle tick dip sites, they're raising their heads again because people are realising many years down the track, oh dear, my house was built adjacent to one of these sites. I didn't know about it at the time, but now I know about it. It is very difficult, and it's very difficult. You can't test for everything that could contaminate, you know, your area. So you've really just got to show a bit of due diligence, try to do a little bit of historical investigation when you buy your house, check with the local council, look at some old maps, things like that. I know it's, you know, tedious and it's extra work, but really to protect ourselves and our families, it's the only way to do it.